Hi, and welcome to Collider Science. Here you find answers about cognition that you may or may not have asked yourself. This episode is hosted by Imogen Hüsing and Sophie Kühne. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode.
A big topic in AI currently is to implement different biological systems. And today we're going to talk about exactly that with Dr. Tonio Weidler, who is a postdoc at Maastricht University and also did his PhD there. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us. We will start with our get to know game, as always. And for that, we are going to ask you or give you the beginnings of 5 sentences that we ask you to finish spontaneously. And the first sentence is, as a kid, I always wanted to be.
I think an actor, actually.
That's quite
I really enjoyed drama class. So I think I took the wrong turn at some point.
If I was an emoji, I would be.
I'm gonna go with my most used emoji, which is the hugging face.
The what?
The.
Ah, cute.
Yeah, this doesn't really work in audio, but it's two waving hands next to a smiley face that smiles very cutely.
And the next sentence is my favorite thing to do on a day off is.
Going cycling. Or playing padel. So somehow moving, because I sit a lot on the desk and in front of a desk. sometimes also on a desk. It depends on my mood. But yeah, I have to get moving to refocus.
Nice. Yeah, you probably have a lot of good cycling opportunities in the Netherlands, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm living in the most hilly part of the Netherlands, but it is still the Netherlands, so rather flat. But yeah, it's nice here, for sure.
Okay, the next question is, right now, I'm most fascinated by?
I guess I'm going to focus this on science. I think
you can
I'm
focus I'm, this on
okay.
whatever you want.
Well, okay, now I kind of have something on science. I'm really fascinated by the context of, and I guess that's also probably something we're going to talk about today, embodiment and executive cognition, because I think it's a perspective on how the brain works that is not necessarily currently implemented in the way that we are studying the brain. And it has a lot of roots in more the philosophy of mind, but not so much yet in the actual biological study, empirical study of the mind.
And the last sentence is, I know it's time to call it a day. When?
When it's 5 p.m.
Nice.
Yeah, I try to do work-life balance.
That's good.
Yeah, and we already have a vague idea of what you're fascinated by and what you're researching, but how did you end up here, especially when you started out fascinated with a drama class?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually, that I'm also often asking myself. I think I'm someone that is really interested in a lot of things, and I, at some point, as every 18-year-old after high school, had to decide what to do with life. And I was actually very close to go to Freiburg and study history and German language. But the drama class I kind of discarded very quickly, also maybe because of monetary reasons. But I always was interested in both, let's say, more technical things like computer science and so on, but then also more hermeneutic studies, like something like language or whatever. And I, in the end, then decided to combine the two with computational linguistics, which is basically AI, but for language. But this was all before LLMs and so on were cool. So we were still drawing syntax trees and stuff. But then I also got bored by computer science courses like databases or whatever, and started a minor in psychology. And then I got really fascinated by neuroscience courses and wanted to do as the next step in my master's something where I more understand intelligence as a whole and not only focus on language. So I did an AI master in Maastricht already. And from there, I already tried to do projects, the master thesis and so on in neuroscience. And then slowly shifted and got the opportunity to do my PhD on modeling the human brain with deep neural networks to understand how the brain controls the hand. And this kind of like married different interests of mine, but also challenged me to go in something to something very new, which was robotics and like motor control and so on and so forth. And yeah, then I somehow ended up there. I can assure you that 5 years ago, well, 5 years ago maybe, but let's say 10 years ago, I would have never thought that I'd do anything with robots or whatever. I was always saying like, oh, robots are boring. I want to do language. But I think like sometimes you just end up somewhere.
Definitely. Sometimes life takes you somewhere else.
Also, now I'm doing auditory neuroscience, so it took me somewhere completely different again.
Okay, let's start. So you already mentioned that you use artificial neural networks to model. So can you give a brief explanation what artificial neural networks are and what deep neural networks are?
I mean, they are very close terms. I guess the only difference is the depth. An artificial neural network is a function that takes in some description of data. For instance, an image represented by a bunch of numbers that describe the pixels in that image. And then through repetitive computations on those numbers, and the more of these computations you do in a like cascade, the deeper it gets, and there we arrive at deep neural networks. Through this cascade of computations, you're at some point you arrive at an output. And that might, for instance, be a label that describes what object is present in that picture. And now this requires a lot of parameters that decide how these numbers are multiplied and added to each other. These parameters we can, and this was like probably like the big innovation decades ago, we can train based on a lot of data and some cost function that determines what is a wrong and what is a right answer and how to weigh that in. These models can learn to give the correct answer by small changes to these parameters. This is a very simple description, but through decades of research, we've come up with more and more sophisticated ways of designing these functions in a way that we can solve pretty crazy tasks today, including whatever your favorite chatbot does, which is also based on deep neural networks.
And how are they similar or dissimilar to the brain, and maybe connected to that? Why are we using, or why should we use them to model or understand the brain?
This is a dangerous territory because, of course, this is a very controversial topic, right? I think what probably everyone agrees on that views the brain as a connectionist system, and I think that's relatively established even in cognitive science now, is that the brain computes things through units that are connected to each other, and deep neural networks do the same if you view them conceptually, right? Like I said, it's a function, but in the end you can represent this function abstractly by drawing a bunch of circles, putting numbers into them, and then connecting them via lines that determine how a number is weighed in order to generate the number in the next circle. And so you get some sort of like network graph. And we both see the brain to work roughly in that way, right? We have interconnected units. And in the same way, also these deep neural networks work. But it's also it's a big simplification of a lot of things, right? So the powerhouse of deep learning, the kind of network that we're using there, whenever we are doing something that really has to learn a very complex task, are networks that just code activity, so these numbers in these circles, like a single number that is then just transmitted as a rate to the next stage. Whereas the brain works very different in that it has a bunch of neurons that fire at a rate, but this kind of temporal dimension and the way that repetitively firing neurons are integrated in the brain is entirely missing in the deep neural network models that we are using, even to model the brain. There's models that accommodate for these limitations, but often as you add more biological detail to a network, which is very much possible, you add constraints on the way that it computes things that make it more difficult to either train them or maybe more difficult in general to implement a function. So in this regard, in its very basic design, it is very similar to how the brain conceptually works. But we need to add a lot of additional things in order to really arrive at a model that properly biologically would describe how the brain works. And this is also like the big task, right? So you can model the brain in many different ways. And the more classical kind of models, like biophysical models, for instance, focus on something completely different than deep neural network models of the brain do. They try to more closely emulate how the biological mechanisms work, but thereby give up more on the functions that they can achieve. Whereas the deep neural networks give up on a lot of biological detail, but then can achieve more functional validity.
In our preparation, we read that you also used reinforcement learning in your research. Before we dive deeper in what you did exactly, could you also maybe briefly explain what reinforcement learning is in this context so that we can use the term later on?
Yeah, sure. So in machine learning, we have different ways of training a system to achieve a certain function. And that system, I think for the purpose of this conversation, will always be, I guess, a deep neural network. You can do this in a supervised way, where you have a bunch of data points, for instance, a few million images, and they all have a label, which could be what's in that image, cat or dog, for instance. And then you can train this network by showing it these images, letting it tell you what it thinks is on there, and then giving it an indication of what is whether it's right or wrong. And that's the supervision, basically, right? Like you have labels that supervise the process. You can also train it in a way where you just show images and let it, for instance, reconstruct these images after first condensing them to like very few features. Without telling it what is in there, and then it can kind of like by itself figure out what is important information in order to then reconstruct the image. And the third way is reinforcement learning. And here you don't have prepared data, but rather you are training an agent, which is then the deep neural network, to achieve a task or to learn a task by interacting with this task in, for instance, some environment. So you can also see already that like the task setting is very different. You are not going to just classify something, but you could, for instance, teach it to balance a pole on a cart. And to learn this, you are not going to present it with data points, because the space in which you might want to generate these data points is maybe just too big or too cumbersome to collect. But rather you let it interact with the environment, try things out, and then give it a reward that is based on what you wanted to learn. Right? So it's very close to reinforcement learning in the sense of in the more psychological sense. But the learning rules mustn't be the same or don't have to be the same. And you give these rewards, and then we have different algorithms by which we calculate how we again need to adjust these weights of the deep neural network in order to, in the future, decide on actions to execute, for instance, moving that cart to the left or moving that cart to the right, that will, in the long term, maximize the reward that the system gets. So in short, you have an agent that interacts with an environment based on its actions and the outcome of these actions. You give it some reward, and then you then the agent tries to change its decision-making process in order to maximize the reward that it will get in the future. And then you train this a lot, right? Like, so for instance, the relatively complex task that we tried to achieve during my PhD was to manipulate objects with a robotic hand. And we had to simulate 1.5 years of experience in order to let this agent learn to achieve this task to a satisfactory level. But other things you can very quickly train on your own laptop in minutes, maybe.
I have two questions about this. So this reward, can you apply this to the neural networks we've talked before? And secondly, how do you reward an agent like this? Like, what does it mean? Because obviously we know like how to reward a dog when it does, when it sits, when we ask it to, but it's very hard for me to imagine how to reward an AI.
Yeah, of course. So absolutely can apply to these neural networks, right? Like that's exactly what people are doing there. Actually, even reinforcement learning is even used when training chatbots. The way that we are using a cost function to change the weights in a network is the same between reinforcement learning and supervised learning and so on. It's just how we arrive at the cost that we are going to use is different, right? And also we do not need a data set beforehand. We collect this data online on the fly. But other than that, it's the same way in which we can apply these things to deep neural networks as we can train them with other methods. And then the second question was?
The second question was how you can reward a model or a neural network.
Ah, yeah. So how can you reward a model? We basically write a reward function, right? So we find a way. So in general, we're doing all of this. We have a model on a computer, right? That means that we have a function on a computer that gets some input, does a calculation, and gives us some output. And in this case, this output is an action. And then we are executing this action, for instance, for a robot, how it moves its body in a simulated environment, that like some sort of physics simulation, again, on our computer, right? So we have full introspection on everything that is happening. The agent itself might not have full introspection, right? It has an embodiment, it has a body that it controls and that also has sensors on it. And from these sensors, it might get readings, for instance, in what position its body is, modeling proprioception. Or it can have cameras that model the human eye. But the training algorithm itself has also full access to everything that happens in the simulation. So we can use all of this information and the knowledge of what we want to achieve, like what we want the agent to achieve, in order to calculate a reward that is related to the quality of what's currently happening. Let's say something super simple. I want a robot to push an object towards a goal. I can every time step in my simulation calculate whether the object is now closer to that goal than before. And I can use this number as a reward. If it's getting closer, like the distance covered, I can, for instance, use as a reward. And then I use this number. If it's positive, it's a reward. If it's negative, it's a punishment in a sense, right? I use this number in order to inform an algorithm that calculates from this whether it wants to make the action that the agent executed in order to arrive at this reward more likely or less likely. And we do this mostly in the algorithms that are currently state of the art, not in a way where we have only one instance of this model execute an action and then it updates itself and then it does another action and it updates itself. But instead, we have hundreds of instances of it doing this for a while. We collect a bunch of data and then combine all of this in order to determine whether on average an action in this data set was better than other potential actions in that state. And then we make those actions that are better on average more likely, and those are that are worse on average, we make them less likely. I'm not sure whether this was entirely clear, but...
No, I really like the explanation. Before you mentioned that you modeled 1.5 years of experience with the robotic arm or with the robotic hand. What do you mean exactly with that? Like, did it take 1.5 years to model that, or did you somehow like sped up 1.5 years of experience? And yeah.
So it took me longer. I'm not sure whether that's my fault or the task's fault, but it took me longer to implement all of this. than 1.5 years. But what I mean is the training itself, right? So that's completely hands-off. And we also did this multiple times. In order to not die in front of my computer while waiting on all of these models to learn, we first of all don't simulate in real time, right? So it's 1.5 years of real-time experience. But the speed at which we can simulate this is higher than actual real time. And on top of this, as I also already alluded to a bit before, we use a lot of copies of the same model at the same time and let them all independently show their behavior in the environment, collect data, and then train on this. So In our case, we used 384 copies of this model, let them all do this at the same time. It's a very weird number, but it comes down to the number of CPUs we had available on our server. We do let them do their stuff all at the same time, save all the data from that. And then we let a bunch of GPUs calculate, like graphic cards, we let them calculate how to change the model parameters. And then we do this again and again and again in cycles. And then the 1.5 years of experience were both generated and trained on in only 1 to 2 days.
Okay.
Sorry, this is a little hard to comprehend for me, to be very honest. This makes me wonder about two things. Firstly, so how do you even calculate how long the modeling takes in real time when you do it in a sped up version? And secondly, so all these models that train, they're independent from each other, if I understand correctly, and they just behave differently? Is that...
Yeah, so it's, yeah, so Yeah, there are stochastic models, right? So that's actually an important little detail. They are not deterministically executing their policies or their behavior, but instead they output a probability distribution over all the joints in the hand, in this case, that they are moving. And then we are sampling from this distribution and execute the sampled action. Meaning, at every time step, it is a somewhat random action, but it is most likely that the action is close to what the model thinks is a proper thing to do. Right? So it's random, but the distribution from which we are sampling randomly is very, has its most of the load of its likelihood around the actions that the model thinks are good at the moment. And because of this, if we execute this behavior on about 400 agents at the same time, they will show different behavior. And this is actually also a very important factor in reinforcement learning, that we are balancing between exploring new things, right? Because we don't know yet what's correct, but at the same time also exploiting the knowledge that we've already gathered, right? So I want to explore new things, but if I constantly just explore random stuff, rather than already narrowing it down to things that I've learned that are good, I need to exploit this in order to make progress faster. And this, like striking this balance, is in engineering these algorithms, it's quite difficult. Did that answer the question?
Yes. I think it's very interesting because I'm not very familiar with these kinds of models, and it's very fun to imagine that they all just go and look at the situation and consider, this might be sensible, and then they just go for it.
It's also like, I think the most fun thing about it is that at the end, right, you look at the thing that it learned. Mm-hmm. Right? And then you imagine, okay, this is all going to go super well, right? But there have been so many steps that you've had to kind of figure out in between that for sure something will go very wrong in the beginning, right? And the classic thing with reinforcement learning is that the problem is always that you try to design a reward function that captures the goal of the task. But there's no clear, true, like correct answer to this, I guess. You will have to find something that works, that is efficient, and so on. But sometimes you just forget something completely, right? Like, and then the model makes sure that it finds this small little trick to find a solution to your task that you totally did not want, but that you didn't foresee to be possible with the reward function. You know, it's, for instance, like in the beginning, before we tackled manipulating objects, we prototyped this by just telling it to join the thumb fingertip and another fingertip that we then input, like we told it, for instance, to join the middle finger tip and the thumb tip. And then the next instance, we told it to do the fingertip of the pinky and the thumb, right? And then it always had to find the correct finger. So I just designed a reward function very naively that rewarded the distance between the two fingertips it should join. What it learned to do, however, was just to completely cramp the all fingers together, because then at all time, it always achieved the reward function that I gave it, because I forgot that, oh, well, I also need to distance all the other fingertips, right?
That makes sense.
Maybe briefly, what was the task that the agent or the hand was supposed to learn in your experiment?
In the final one that we employed?
Yeah, in the final one.
So we wanted to study human dexterity. So very fine motoric movements. And we wanted to do this in an ecologically valid way. So some task that is relevant to a human's everyday life. And we found this to be most prototypically represented in manipulating objects, right? Because this is also one of the skills that kind of differentiates us from, or like the dexterity with which we can do this differentiates us from a lot of other animals. So the task it had to achieve was given control over a robotic hand that is human-like. It needed to manipulate the orientation of a cube that was placed in its hand. And this cube had differently colored sides. And then it needed to achieve from the current position of the cube an orientation where, for instance, a different side would face upwards. And then it needed to do this a lot of times in a row, always starting from the last final position that it achieved. And of course, this is not necessarily the specific task that we are interested in understanding, but it is a representation of a general skill set that we are interested in. And then we are trying to analyze the model afterwards because we have full introspection into everything that happens in there in order to understand how it solved this task. And from there, we can then generate hypotheses about how possibly the brain might implement something as complex as dexterous manipulation. Because at the current moment in neuroscience, we have, as with many other things, absolutely no idea how any of this works. So it's very difficult to check whether a hypothesis is true when you can't even come up with a possible hypothesis about how this might be implemented. So where other researchers maybe take more smaller scale hypotheses in order to test them and then say whether they seem to be true, whether there's evidence that they are true or wrong, we are modeling in order to generate hypotheses by trying to make models implement a function in a somewhat biologically constrained way that we do not currently understand how possibly the brain could give rise to them.
What were the hypotheses that came out of this modeling task?
So we didn't go the full way of generating testable hypotheses. Because this is also the first work that really tries to solve such a complex way with so much biological realism. But for instance, one of the we found mechanisms by which we could potentially explain how actions are planned in regions of the brain that then forward these plans to other regions of the brain that will then ultimately inform your muscles on how to move the body. And there's multiple steps here, of course, right? Like many steps in this processing pipeline, also in the brain. It is not clear at all how they interact and how information and plans are designed in order to achieve these functions. We generated an idea of how that could be possible and how plans change from step to step. And on top of this, we also found evidence in our models of behavior being not learned in isolation, but being built up from building blocks, something we call motor primitives. So behavior is basically at every point, not completely built from scratch, but you have a bunch of, let's say, Lego blocks that you're combining in a way that helps you to achieve the function, but you don't have to build the Lego block from scratch again. You can reuse partial skills that you've built before in order to solve different behavioral tasks. However, a small disclaimer, I'm not claiming that this is actually how the brain solves this. It's just something where we found evidence, not proof, for in our model and not the brain.
That makes sense. I have more questions about the model. I'm having a very hard time imagining this. So it's basically one hand trying to rotate this block? Can it put it down in between, or does it have to rotate it in the end? Okay. And you talked about these small movement Lego blocks. Mm-hmm. What size of movement? Like, would moving my index finger be a block like this, or would grabbing already be a block like this? Is grabbing like a complex block, or is grabbing a building block?
Grabbing is definitely a complex block, I would say, because it involves a lot of things. It involves a lot of smaller movements. Right? But you can put this at different levels of a hierarchy. Right? Grabbing something is then also a smaller movement, or a smaller skill, a smaller building block to yet another level of more complex behaviors. But if we really talk of motor primitives, then we have really like a low level of these building blocks. But and this is nothing where there's necessarily proof yet for, but I believe that the entire brain, or everything from perception to action, is built in this way. We are building things from parts that we train individually and reuse for other skills. But this is not something we have shown through our work. It's just an ongoing discussion in the field. And in our specific work, we found evidence for these building blocks to be present, because we can show that the information in the behavior, in the code that describes the behavior, that this is can be narrowed down to very few variables that are not necessarily sufficient to describe the full behavior. So we believe that these are these building blocks that can be combined, rather than needing some representation of the behavior that is complex enough to describe all possible behaviors. However, we did not yet, because we don't have a clever way yet of checking this, we have not yet determined what these building blocks actually look like. So I would assume that it could, for instance, be some periodic movement in a finger. And if you combine different or one of these, like, you can get some sort of like grabbing behavior. But I cannot tell you necessarily in our model or in general what these would be.
That's really cool. And you said you also work with robotics. So do you then apply what this hand has learned in these simulations to a robotic hand?
So actually, no. When I said robotics, I mean more in the sense of we are simulating a robot, right? So we are not actually simulating fully like a biological hand, but we are simulating a robotic hand that looks and works like a human hand. These are a few hoops to hop through. The reasons for this are what people showed before that is possible. Actually, the simulation is a simulation of a physical existing hand. My PI at the time, Rainer Goebel, he considered buying this hand. But then we saw the price tag, and we were like, okay, we have a choice. Either we buy this hand, or we hire another PhD candidate for 4 years. And then the decision was made towards human capital, rather a hand that does also not really help us in our research, but would just be fancy and cool to show that we can translate this to a robot. Which, by the way, is also another whole like box of Pandora that you can open, how complex it is to learn a behavior in simulation and then having to actually translate it into the real world. Because often things in simulation and in the real world don't necessarily match in all their parameters.
Maybe adjacent to that, what are particular challenges in modeling the motor system? Because I think a lot of research in this area is still focused on the visual system. or at least I know a lot of research. I know is over exaggeration, but like all the research that I know about this is around the visual system and some the auditive system. But yeah, what are the challenges around the motor system?
Yeah, like you're completely right. Most research that models the brain as we do it, and honestly, most research in general that models the brain focuses on perception, be it auditory system or be it the visual system. Other systems, very rarely, because I don't know.
The olfactory system.
Yeah, good God, Oh, gustatory. Like, that's just stuff where, yeah. It's also, I think it would be cool, but I think both sound and vision are kind of also more approachable to look at, maybe. And they're maybe also two of the most important senses. Somatosensation, so the ability to touch and feel something, is also studied a bit more. But the thing is why maybe more people focus on these is because they are the very first step in a system from perception to action, right? So if you only look at the first step, you remove a lot of complexity down the pipeline because you take some sort of subtask for the behavior you are in the long term interested, like for instance, classifying objects in an image that is relevant for everything we do in our everyday life. But you can also focus only on the task. The problem is if you go for the motor system, you cannot just look at the motor system because the motor system needs some sort of input. And you could, of course, fake some sort of like surrogate input by already coding what you think the output of, for instance, the visual system would be, and then putting that into the motor system. But you won't be very sure whether that's actually what the visual system does, right? So the way that we look at these things kind of requires us to model not just the motor system, but all the steps from perception to motor. And that adds a lot of complexity, both in the coverage of the brain, but also in the modalities that we are integrating. So, for instance, haptic information and visual information. Also the number of parameters you have to look at, the way that different regions are interconnected and how you model them differently, right? Maybe the visual system has a lot of similarities with how the motor system is constructed on a neural level. But there are definitely differences, and all of these things you have to suddenly account for. And then in the end, you even have to execute the behavior that the network creates and then get new sensory input that you're feeding back into the perception. That's just like, it's a much bigger system that you have to take care of.
Okay. So in your model, what type of sensory information did your model need or use?
Need or use is a difference, I guess. The need is difficult to answer. It uses haptic information. So we have about 90 touch sensors on the hand that constantly have readings. And if something, either the hand itself or the cube touches it, it has some response. And that's then presented to the model. And we have proprioceptive information, which is the sense of like of your own body position. And we represent this via both the current position of a joint, as well as the velocity at which the joint position is changing. In short, the position of the body, the position of the hand. And that's it. We were originally planning to do this also with visual information, but it turned out that blows up the complexity, the size of the model so much that it didn't fit our GPUs anymore. Instead of this visual information, we feed as I mentioned earlier already a bit, surrogate information actually in this case in. So we feed the position and the orientation that is currently the case of the cube as what we would expect the visual cortex to extract from visual information. But through smaller experiments, we are relatively certain that it's relatively trivial to train a visual model on extracting this information and then just plugging it into the larger model. So we haven't extensively tested what information is exactly used. However, some of the, let's say, interim analyses that I've run give me the indication that the haptic information is actually relatively irrelevant to the entire process. So the most important information that the network receives is its own body position, the position of the cube, and of course the goal that it needs to achieve.
Okay. Very interesting. I would have thought that like the haptics of, especially if you manipulate something, because like the limit of understanding of what I have of robotics is that grabbing stuff is actually really hard. I would have thought that the haptic information is quite important.
Interesting
that it doesn't seem to be.
It might be due to many things, right? Like there's a lot of limitations, of course, always to what we or probably anyone is doing. And in our specific case, because we are using just simulations of robotics, the sensor information isn't perfect. And it could be due to the quality of these haptic sensors. It could be that maybe the information that the proprioceptive sensors are providing are too good. And hence, it's too easy to actually calculate from this and the position of the cube everything you need without actually knowing what touches what. So because like, again, right, like we have a model where we are claiming better, and I would also stand behind that, more biological realism than most models of on the market. But it's still extremely limited. And a lot of things that make it difficult for the brain to extract information from its own senses are not actually modeled in our model. For instance, the time delay between you actually sensing the position of your body and this information then arriving as a signal in your brain, because that's not instantaneous. So there's always a delay. And this delay, of course, makes the task more difficult because you are having a delay from when the information is measured to when you're processing it. And then you have another delay while you're processing it, and yet another one from when you decide on which action to take and when it's actually executed now in the brain, right? Like in the actual biological system. And all of these delays are left unmodeled. In our case. And I think also these are some of the details that I would deem some of the most relevant to incorporate in the future. Next to, for instance, additionally to this, there's always noise inherently in all of these processes. There's noise to the sensory readings. There's noise in the transmission of the readings to the brain. There's noise in every little activity happening in the brain. And all of this, and then there's, of course, also noise to when you execute a movement with a muscle. And all of this is also not modeled in current DNN models of the brain. So these factors definitely play a role. And then also make it maybe too easy to deduct information from, for instance, proprioception.
I was thinking, could haptic information maybe be more important if the hand was tasked to manipulate like multiple different objects with different textures, different weights, and so on? Maybe like it was used to the cube that it just could rely on hand positions and the haptic sensors weren't as important.
So let's say, for instance, we wouldn't feed in the actual cue position, instead we actually have vision there, right? And then we are altering the task in a way that there's occlusions. So I don't always see fully the object because something is in the way. Then maybe I need to use haptic information more to actually feel in what position it is. But maybe I can, instead of also color, add different textures to the different sides of the cube. And maybe this information is then also more interesting to integrate into a process. In the end, it really boils down to the task, right? And I think the problem here is also that we are building a model that is focused on learning one specific task. And we are trying to, at the same time, arrive at a mechanism that integrates the full potential of all the senses that we have. But maybe the task at hand does not, need all this complexity, right? Or like need all of these possibilities. So also in this regard, it would be better if we would actually train it on multiple things or like a more generalizable behavior.
In the beginning, you mentioned that you're currently most interested in embodiment. Maybe we can circle back to that because you said that it was also somewhat related to your research. Very briefly, because embodiment is a big topic, but could you very briefly introduce what the notion of embodiment is?
Yeah. So there's different notions of embodiment. One notion I would use now is that we believe that the human, or like that the mind is not just software running on a hardware, which would be the body, independently of it, but that body and mind are entirely integrated in their functioning and completely rely on each other. And you can have different extents of this. There are some authors in the philosophy of mind that I think it was Gallagher that says that, for instance, a weak notion of embodiment would be that it suffices to say the brain is the body implementation of the mind, and it matters that it is implemented with your specific brain and the way that it's wired, and that matters to the cognition. But that is a very weak perspective on it. And a more strong one would be that actually the entire body, the entire state of your body, up to your little toe, influences how you think. As an example, when I defended my PhD thesis, one of the people that were challenging my work, but also challenging the notion of embodiment. And they asked their question by taking a pen and then very comically putting it into their mouth and asking, is my cognition differently? Am I thinking differently now? And that's the idea, right? Like you make a difference, like you change how your body, the state of your body, and that has an influence on how you think on every level. And not just as the information that's fed into your mind, but in the way that the mind functions or calculates things. And I believe that is a more sound way of thinking about how cognition works than considering cognition to be entirely independent of the own body in the sense of a computer that has some sort of like general computing capabilities, then just generates an output, isn't influenced by the host of this computer. I've probably not done this entire field justice with this definition, but I think the takeaway message is body and mind are closely, intricately connected to each other in every cognitive step.
And so You're modeling a hand flipping a cube. How does this, so how does embodiment apply to this? So is it the interaction?
Yeah. So perception is usually what people are studying in neuroscience in isolation, right? So there's not much work that does the full from perception to motor. That makes some sense, and I think it is very valuable work to do this if you want to find out very if you want to find very small mechanistic explanations about small processes in some sensory system like the visual cortex. However, I believe that even in the earliest visual cortex regions, the processing of information is ultimately influenced by the intentions of the human itself. So if I want to achieve a certain task, a certain goal in my current situation, this influences, in my opinion, the way that even primary visual cortex processes information from the environment. One example of this is what's called affordance theory, which basically posits that we do not represent the world in a way where we create general representations of objects around us, like for instance of a chair that I can see, that can then be used for anything, but that we create more like mental states that correlate with that object that then help us to achieve the specific goal that I have. An easier or a more practical example of this would be, for instance, with the chair, that I do not represent the chair precisely by the length of its legs, how they are relatively to each other, how slanted they are on and so on and so forth, the material and so forth and so on. But if I want to currently, if I'm exhausted and I want to sit down, then I represent the chair in a way that tells me that I can sit down on it. But if I currently want to reach something on a shelf that is way higher than I am tall, I represent the chair in a way that makes it clear to me that I can use it as a fake ladder. And if we believe that that is true, then in order to understand how information in our environment from our senses is represented and integrated in order to achieve a task, then we need to study this relative to the current intentions, the current goals of the human agent. And as I said, I still think it is worth it to look at these things in isolation to answer some questions. But if we want to understand how everything connects, we need to incorporate the intentions and the goals of an agent. And that also relates to the body. Because, of course, part of the state, right, and is also, if I look at the chair, for instance, it is relevant that I have legs and I have the capability of stepping on that chair. If I would have lost my legs before and I'm sitting in a wheelchair, then this chair in front of me makes no sense as a means of reaching something that is situated somewhere highly.
That makes sense. What do you think, or how could possible future applications of this look?
We are doing fundamental research. So what we are doing doesn't have a direct implication for any clinical research. There's always a lot of steps afterwards that will ultimately make this useful for someone. So of course this can be used, like if you're looking at studying how the hand controls stuff, we can maybe at some point use this in order to build prostheses. because we understand how we need to connect the brain to a prosthetic arm. Or if we build models of the motor system that are so realistic that lesioning certain parts of it actually results in the same effect in the model as in the brain, and then the behavior of the of a patient. We can check what certain real lesions have on a patient, and maybe also test interventions. But there's a lot of work until we ever arrive there. And currently what we are doing is more setting the stage for that by understanding, making sense of what is even possible. And this is not yet a very matured research agenda yet.
I think you've already touched on this a little bit, but how would you say does your work relate to cognition?
I think that's a good question, and that's ultimately a question of what do you define as cognition? Because actually, a lot of times we've been, so of course all the work we do is like reviewed by people, partially by people where we want to, that check whether we can publish what we've done, but also partially by people who check whether it was worth it to give us money to do this. And particularly the latter group often asks, but where's the cognition? Because this does not really fit into the classical maybe categories or like kind of mechanisms that you maybe study in cognitive models. However, I think that because we are modeling something from perception to behavior, if we say that there will be something that we would maybe in the grand maybe define as cognition should give should be emerging in between, right? So the model will need to do things like planning. Maybe you might already define a lot of the perception parts as cognition. So definitely, because the behavior we are covering, we are deeming a lot of the cognitive process to be relevant for that behavior. We also think that they kind of emerge in our models. So in the end, what we learn about how the brain controls the body also teaches us something about cognition in general. And that is particularly true if you follow my beliefs, which is that in the end, all cognition is embodied, and hence motor control always will be closely related and woven with cognition.
I think that summarizes it very well. And if somebody listened to this episode, what do you think would be like two good things to take away?
I would like people to think more about the whole thing about embodiment, and how we as beings kind of evolved in a way that our brains are built to achieve actions and not built to just represent the world and then do symbolic computations on them. And I think this might sound very intuitive at first, but it has a lot of influence on how we think about our own thinking. How maybe we can also, in a very practical way, be forgiving to ourselves when we feel like, oh, I feel so stupid today, but maybe we didn't eat well enough. Maybe we are tired in general, and this always will influence how we are thinking. And I think this is something to kind of take away for your everyday life, but also at the same time to take away for when you're studying the brain. That would be my first thing. My second thing is motor and robots are really cool, but they are also really, really complicated. And maybe sometimes it's better, and this is also a take-home message for myself, to study smaller problems first.
Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
This was KaleidoScience. We hope that you enjoyed this episode and we would love to have your feedback. You can rate our podcast and give us feedback on our Instagram account. Have a great week and you'll hear from us again in 2 weeks. This episode was hosted by Imogen Hüsing and Sophie Kühne. Produced by Imogen Hüsing, Clara Kühne, Sophie Kühne, Sönke Lülf and Elisa Palmer. The music is from Jan-Lukas Schröder and the logo is from Annika Richter.